Hey, welcome back to Invisible Machines. I'm Josh Tyson, a contributing editor here at UX Magazine, and I'm joined again by resident visionary Rob Wilson, CEO and co-founder of OneReach.ai. Rob and I are co-authors of the best-selling book Age of Invisible Machines, and this podcast is where we continue our explorations of agentic AI. Today, we're talking with Brian Solis, a digital anthropologist and futurist who serves as the head of global innovation at ServiceNow and previously led innovation at Salesforce. Brian is a best-selling author of numerous books, and his most recent work, Mindshift, helps leaders learn how to spot important emerging trends, harness disruptive forces, and fuel growth. Brian has also published more than 60 research reports across industries, and he's here today to talk with us about the importance of self-disruption in AI adoption. With so many Gen AI projects failing to reach production, we look at approaches taken by IKEA and Airbnb that have induced the kind of mind shift that invites self-disruption. Brian, who's been called the CEO whisperer, talks about the sometimes nuanced difference between aha and uh-oh moments and the pitfalls of hopeless optimism. We also explore what a world awash in simulations and predictions might actually look like. This is a brisk, jam-packed episode, so get ready for a stimulating conversation with Brian Solis. So, well, Brian, one of the things that we were thinking about as we were looking at your book, Mindshift, was this idea that we come across a lot. We were talking to the authors of a book called AI First, and they were showing examples, actually, of CEOs and business leaders having kind of these aha moments with AI, I guess, for lack of a better term, and how a lot of times it would be something personal, like they would take pictures of, you know, ingredients in their refrigerator, and it would give them a recipe, and that would sort of open up their mind to all the possibilities that this technology might bring to their business. But we've also been talking about how there's this important second tempering moment where you realize that, yeah, we could do anything, but what should we do? It's like sort of that get to the why exercise, like, what should we do with this technology? What are its limitations? What are the ways we could actually use it in meaningful ways rather than just kind of like this fire hose approach of kind of drenching everything in bolt-on AI? And I was wondering, you know, in your experience, is that an important part of the shift in this kind of post-industrial AI first world that we're entering into?
I always say that there's two moments of learning, whether it's AI or any disruptive technology, and that's either the aha moment, which is a productive, proactive opportunity, and then there's the uh-oh moment, which is when something happens and you're late, and you realize just what a big deal it is. And so the fact that you are working with C-suites or leaders that are having more aha moments than uh-oh moments is tremendous. But then again, you're probably talking to folks who read your book when it originally came out, and you were way ahead of the curve. So you gave people runway, I'd imagine, to start thinking seriously about this. But to answer your question specifically, that is the moment of a potential mind shift when you realize that something is so profound that it stops you in your tracks. And where that mind shift really unlocks is when you recognize that the opportunity to learn forward is when you unlearn, when you don't assume, when you don't lean on your gut or intuition, and you decide to bring a beginner's mind to this moment, to see it more clearly for what it is and what it could be versus how you would normally think about it or attack it with all of your experience and all of your biases in that moment.
Josh was, you know, doing a little homework, and we saw that, yeah, you've been called the CEO whisperer. I'm interested in what that looks like for you. Like, what, because it really is the technology existing, that's one thing, but applying it, getting it into the hand, like, that's the real thing, right? What are they talking about? Like, if you were to try to figure out, like, why they say you're the CEO whisperer, what's the thing you bring to the table to help them think about this and bridge this navigate these waters? That's sort of like Ahab moment.
Well, first of all, I have a hard time with any title or any compliment. Just to be honest.
Well, you're in good company then, okay?
I was surprised when the first time I had heard that, but I did try to make sense of it, because I was just showing up transparently and authentically to moments, understanding from an empathetic perspective what a CEO has to think about, the pressures that they're under, the things that they're prioritizing, the things that they prioritize, and the things that they're asked to prioritize. You think about, you know, depending on the size of the organization, they could be surrounded by boards of directors, shareholders, certainly stakeholders, and they have a certain series of pressures that they're under, but also a series of responsibilities that are unique to that C-suite. And they also speak their own language, I've learned over the decades. And speaking their language empathetically, it demonstrates, one, that you took the time to really think about who they are, what they care about, what keeps them up at night, but also that you took the time to learn how to speak their language. And that that empathetic approach, I would say, was always inspired by the Undercover Boss series. I don't know if you ever watched that
yeah,
show.
Yeah, I know, right?
But you can always...
Enough to catch pieces.
I used to joke, like, I love that show, even though it had the same ending every episode. But there was a moment in every episode where you could see the gift of empathy sort of illuminate within those leaders. And that was recognizing that they had to step outside of their, whatever you want to call it, the boardroom, the corner office, to see what it was like to be an employee, to be a customer, in different facets of their organization. So that whisper, I guess, was just really about being empathetic to them, but also being able to bridge all of the different trends, all of the different opportunities, all of the different challenges in a way that they could appreciate, and also help them translate it back to the way that others around them would need to hear it in order to do something about it.
So one thing that I don't know why, I'm allergic to some of these statements that people generally make, and maybe I'm not allergic to the statement, but just the lack of follow through on the statement. But they'll say things like, you can't be afraid to fail. And I'm trying to empathize and be on their side. And I'm like, how, that's not helpful. Like, what? That doesn't seem helpful. Like, don't be afraid to fail. You got to move fast or you're going to lose. Like, none of this stuff feels meaningful from their perspective. What's your thoughts on this kind of like this general concept of don't be afraid to fail? I always see it as, it's not about failure. It's about redefining success and then succeeding at the new definition of success. This idea that like failure is okay. No, it's not okay. It's just that you have to redefine what the rules are and what winning looks like, and then win at that. I don't know. You tell me.
Well, I came up in Silicon Valley, not too far, Rob, from where you are. I guess the whole Bay Area could now be considered Silicon Valley. And that is certainly a mantra: fail fast, fail forward, move fast, break things. Common things that you'll hear. You'll probably see them on billboards up and down 101. But I think the reality is that we as human beings were taught that failing is bad. We were taught to follow the rules. We're measured by how well we operate within the box that we constantly are told to break out of. So all of those things do not come as second nature. Whether someone tells you to go fail, all they're saying is you're going to have to think differently and try and experiment in ways that you're not used to, which is what makes this such a difficult conversation. Because when we'll hear things as basic as, hey, change is hard, or we'll hear about methodologies around change management, none of that is the language of human beings. So what we try to do is understand what are the opportunities before someone? So my work at ServiceNow, but also my work as a long-term futurist and analyst, has been to study emerging trends. Not all emerging trends were going to be disruptive, and not all disruptive trends were going to be lasting. But I did try to study those trends and analyze them in ways that I could present as stories, not just scenarios, but as stories that would be relatable to whomever my stakeholder was, whether that was a C-suite, whether that was a board, whether that was an investor, to inspire them to see themselves in that story and to inspire them to at least spark just enough curiosity where they would want to learn more and they'd want to understand the consequences of not exploring these ideas or these opportunities, what experiments would look like, what it would cost, and how could we measure sort of risk versus any semblance of reward or return. And so I tend not to embrace Silicon Valley mantras unless I'm talking to a founder and entrepreneur, because that's their love language. And really try to understand who I'm speaking with to help them feel like this is something that they at least want to learn more about. And I learned all of that from Disney and Pixar, surrounding myself with storyboard artists, and understanding the art of storytelling. Cause that's another thing that you could also be allergic to, is you gotta be a storyteller. Well, what does that even mean? And so
I believe in the meaning behind it, but yes. How does one practically take that advice and say, oh, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah. So I've had storytelling in some way, shape, or form in the last three books that I've written. And in particular, in this one, I brought in someone by the name of Nicholas Sung. He's a former Disney Pixar storyboard artist. He worked on one of my favorite Pixar movies, which was Up. For example, and I'm a big geek, a big Disney geek, big Walt Disney fan, but I never really understood their approach to storytelling until I started to spend time with their storyboard artists. And the only reason that happened was happenstance. I used to do work with Airbnb, a big fan of Brian, one of the co-founders and CEO, and he brought in Nicholas Sung when Airbnb went through that incredible transformation about a decade ago. And Nicholas Sung brought in his storyboard technique, his storytelling technique, to win over the boards, to win over all of the investors that Airbnb needed another massive round of funding in order to go through that big transformation they went through. And what they did was they took all of the data and made it empathetic and embraceable, and more importantly, a word that I learned out of that whole process was believable. So, for example, they told the story of why people would put their homes or rooms or condos up for rent to strangers, and they humanized the story of why people would want to rent from strangers or stay in their homes versus a Four Seasons or a Marriott or a Hilton. And they looked at the data in order to tell those stories, and they broke out those stories for the host and they broke out those stories for the guests in their different, they didn't even use the word personas, more like characters, and brought it to life in a way that people could then get their arms around. But more importantly, in true Pixar Disney fashion, it opened your heart, it opened your mind. You felt like you were in that storyline. You laughed, you cried, you wanted to see it again. And so that art I brought Nick after he did all that work with Airbnb to help me with a book called X, The Experience When Business Meets Design. And then I brought him in again to help me take that storyboarding process to systematize or put together a framework, methodology, whatever word you're not allergic to help you humanize the story of the future that they needed to invest in today so that they could play the character and have the outcome that story could tell.
This episode is brought to you by OneReach.ai, the runtime for AI agents. Their GSX platform provides turnkey private architecture and tools for building enterprise-grade agentic solutions. Recently, I worked with the team at OneReach to create an agentic companion for the second edition of Age of Invisible Machines. So now when you scan any of the QR codes found in either edition of the book, an agent is there to provide additional insight using a custom knowledge base. There's also a news feed feature with updates on agentic AI, as well as this podcast, and a book resources skill that provides clickable galleries of footnotes from each chapter. All of it built using the revolutionary Generative Studio X platform. Learn more at onereach.ai. Well, Rob, you've probably even been in experiences with business leaders where you're telling that story and then the technology kind of becomes central to that story in a way, right? Like, we're talking about the need to see that aha moment, but then also to kind of see the distinct possibilities of how these technologies can be arranged and orchestrated to meet a business need. That can be powerful too, right? Because that the story should hopefully include like something actionable like that, right? Where they're now connected with next steps.
I would probably rearticulate it as like in a way to help them understand what the technology can do. Stories help them figure out how to think about it. Not necessarily like how they apply it. That's like secondary. Like, what are the things this can do first? Then, great. Now, what things can I do with it? Second. I wanted to, cause this is so massive. Like usually you can lasso a rope around like, what can this technology do? And this, there is no boundaries that you can wrap around this. You can't draw the edges of what, an LLM and this probabilistic, even, you know, diffusion models and transformers, there's no rope you can draw around this on what it can do. It's a very different mentality of like, what can't it do? It's a shorter list of the conversation. But one thing I wanted to chat with you about, like looking forward a little bit, is I'm always thinking about this ultimate concept of what I'm calling like business to prompt to business, like this idea that one day you just provide a prompt, like, hey, I want to start a moving company, and you give it a budget, and it spawns agents, and like, that's it. Now you just wait and see if it's successful or not.
I look at people like I admired the work and thinking of Greg Eisenberg. I don't know if you follow his work, but he's a serial entrepreneur, and he's always at it. He's at least got 3, 4, 5 companies in the hopper at any one time. And right now his big investment, and he puts a spotlight on it. He lives very much in the public spotlight in real time of his ideas and how he's cranking agents to pursue these businesses. He's got so many ideas that he's giving ideas away on X, for example. But every one of these is spun up in an AI native fashion, which, to your point earlier, say the more legacy leaders that I work with, they cannot get their mind around what that is and how that works, because they're so used to having a traditional org chart. They're used to having structure, hierarchy, processes. And that's one of the biggest challenges I know you've probably faced, I face in my work, which is, and this is actually the whole reason why I wrote Mindshift, was AI is just one of the many disruptive, transformational things that are happening in our world right now. If you look back to, we could look at just the U.S. You could look at the elections of 2016, 2020, 2024. You could look at COVID in 2020. You could look at climate change. You could look at polarization in social media. You could look at news and information, reality, the decimation of trust and truth. All of these are absolutely disruptive events that are not going to regress, and they have forever changed our trajectory forward. And what we haven't changed is our mindset. So we could use AI as an example. When AI was emerging, you were first to see it and call it out, and you provided frameworks that help people see it differently. But I'm sure you saw most of the time people just wanted to say, well, what's a practical use case that I could use to demonstrate a quick win?
How can I do password reset?
Yeah, not how can I employ agents to start an entirely new organization where there's one or two.
How do I like not need passwords in my organization?
Yeah. And so they'll look at things like anywhere from how do I automate what we just digitized through digital transformation, and in create greater efficiencies, greater scale, lower costs, etc. But they won't say, if I had to reimagine my organization today with no more than 20 employees and the rest with AI agents, what would that look like? So taking your question and then challenging how I would disrupt myself or my own organization. Mm. Because what happens is,
that's interesting.
Is that you need both. You need to understand how you can make your business more efficient, but that's assuming that what your business is doing today and the value it creates for the market is infinite, which we know it's not. So you still need that automation, which I would equate to iteration, doing what we did yesterday better.
Yeah, I like that. I see, that seems practical. Like, sit down and figure out how you disrupt yourself, or think about the fight. Like, that feels like, okay, next morning I can wait. I can do something. That seems very actionable.
That's the aha moment. I always say disruption is a gift that's given to you or because of you. And if you're willing to disrupt yourself, that's where all innovation starts. And then I try to make innovation practical by saying, look, iteration is what you did yesterday, better, cheaper, faster. Innovation is what you didn't do yesterday. And if you're not investing, at least in the experimentation through these technologies to disrupt yourself, to find new value, to create new value, then someone else is going to do it. And especially in an era of AI, if you just focus on iteration, the best you can ever do is create that linear model of greater profitability and growth. But with AI, if you're constantly disrupting yourself and you're asking these really tough questions that you don't want to know the answers to, but you get them and you start thinking about them, now you're starting to approach the unknown and you're starting to create a methodology around embracing the unknown and experimenting in the unknown. And the next thing you know, each little experiment starts to create this exponential growth curve. And the delta between that exponential growth curve and that linear curve is disruption. In this case, it's productive disruption because you're investing in yourself in iteration and innovation. Otherwise, someone else is going to figure out the exponential curve, and your ability to suddenly overnight compete against that is probably impossible.
Yeah. I was talking to Cassie Kozergoff the other day.
First and former chief decision officer at Google.
Yes, that's it. Thank you.
No problem.
And she kind of brings up this concept that organizations are used to like seeking simplicity, like trying to find the elegant, simple solution so that the one that every human in their company can understand, to try to create alignment, right? And she's like, in this world now, you have to embrace complexity. You know, this is now like, you got to run towards the complex because now, you know, now we can solve the complicated problems. Now we're not limited by humans needing simple ideas. What are your thoughts around that? What's your version?
Well, she stated it eloquently. I would say that a lot of companies like to look for the easy button. And the easy button is what it is because you know that it generates known results. And I always say that in this era, embracing the complexity is, I would approach it in the way that venture capitalists or investors approach their decision-making. They have formulas, they have models, they have questions that they use in order to be able to substantiate TAM that is unknown, adoption that is unknown, evolution that is unknown. So those complexities have been managed and continue to be managed in ways that I feel like most decision makers for traditional organizations could benefit from. All technologists could also benefit from those exercises too, because it changes the narrative from AI to business value or business impact or competitiveness. All of the languages of the C-suite that I feel like the more that we enable technology to to empower and transform our businesses and it against a vision, then the more forward-looking we can become versus reactive. Most organizations are reactive today because they're not leaning into the future. Most companies heard of generative AI when ChatGPT launched. Your book came out before ChatGPT launched. So these conversations should have already been happening, I guess is my point. And so she's right. And now we have to make up for lost time. But that's why I always say disruption is a personal choice. It starts with you. That mind shift means that you are ready to embrace exploring the unknown, unlearning, and learning forward in order to be able to now start to make the uncertain, the unknown, and possibilities much more tangible and hopefully fun along the way. But translating those things into business value or market value or the things that a business needs to thrive. Many senior executives, they're held to quarterly performance.
Right.
And that is all consuming. And it's really difficult to break out of those cycles because if you miss a quarter, your entire future is going to be in the hands of not just your shareholders, but potentially activist investors who want to see you get back on track and delivering against the value that you went public with. So the challenge is not lost on me. But this is why I do believe in that co-investment strategy or that parallel strategy of iteration and innovation, where you are proving your quarter-to-quarter value or whatever you're measured by driving growth, using all of these new technologies to find new ways in order to do that, but also investing in that longevity against disruption and wherever that disruption can come from. But I think the other wonderful conversation, I'm a hopeless optimist if you haven't been able to tell, but
I think you'd have to be as anyone who looks forward. Otherwise, why would you?
That's probably the simplest and most profound way I've ever heard that. But yeah, it's true. It's one of the reasons why I can't watch the news these days. They just can't let it affect my work. But when you can see things, forward, and you can see things forward optimistically, it allows you to do the research, the work, the thinking, the creativity necessary to be able to demonstrate that there are paths forward. That even though there are costs associated with these experiments, and not all experiments are going to succeed, that we are going to learn along the way, and we are going to unlock opportunities for new value creation along the way. And when you do that, you're able to communicate good old-fashioned ROI. But at the same time, if you take an economist approach or a venture capitalist approach, I always joke and say, well, the other meaning for ROI is return on ignorance, which is what's the cost of not doing these things? You know, if we want to talk about risk mitigation, let's talk about the risk of not doing these things as well, so that you're telling a narrative of which people will say things like, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way before. Or I hadn't seen it that way before. Now I can't unsee it. So those are meaningful conversations to have. You just have to want to have them. In order to have them, you have to break out of the cycle of the vicious cycle, I should say, of just whatever those measures are, however you're measured for success. Just remember that it's always based on the rearview mirror, but the future is always happening tomorrow. It's going to happen with or without us. So what role do we want to play in shaping it?
Yeah, I know you, like many other folks similar that look forward, you typically see it not in one future, but in versions of possibilities of futures, right? It's a parallel universes that could happen, not one universe. So future casting is always about which future. And one of the futures I'm interested in is like what it on the ground actually looks like for companies that don't do what they need to do, that stay, you know, keep their head in the hole. Like what is on the ground that going to look like in that, you know, whatever, that one version of the future?
First, Rob, thanks for pointing that out, because if you want a certain version of the future, don't bring in a futurist, bring in a science fiction author.
Right.
And by the way, I've done that too, because I wanted to explore certain scenarios that would be whimsical to someone's ability to create entirely new worlds. And those have been fascinating. But that is one scenario, to your point, that can be likely. And those scenarios are really important to play out, especially now. So think about all of the waves of generative AI that are still ahead of us. Let's think about AGI that's ahead of us. Let's think about quantum. Let's think about quantum and AGI together. Each one of those are going to unlock potential scenarios that most organizations are not prepared for. If you think about our military, at least theoretically, is supposed to plan for all kinds of scenarios so that they can have options to consider should any of those come to life. And most of them don't, but they're prepared. They're always prepared. And I believe that now more than ever, C-suites need futurists. They need anthropologists. They need psychologists, and they need not creative professionals from a marketing or a brand standpoint, because they need those too, but they need people who can think objectively, think openly, and feel the psychological safety to experiment, to ask questions, to challenge conventions, to challenge the status quo. Because in all of these ways, the scenarios that we could see forward give C-suites, investors, shareholders, stakeholders, if you can make those stories relatable and believable, it makes them more interested in doing something about tomorrow today, especially if you can tie incentivization to it, because that's a whole nother psychology that we could talk about, because then people feel like there's something in it for them, and that's human nature.
Yeah. I want to run a concept. I've thrown it out there to a couple of folks. I've always imagined, and I'll put it in a different context to you, but like if a futurist designed a device, you know, the Johnny Ives of futurists, what would it be, right? And I always picture this like pendant or something that hangs around your neck that captures your environment, right? It's a video camera, it's audio, and you walk down the street and you may pass like four or five different people. So you get to stop and you can pause and be like, wait, was that my friend from high school? And you can rewind and go back and see. But then you can go forward. It can generate five different versions of what you could do next. And you can watch it to decide like which version, like because we have the past, we can generate the future. And now I just watch this storyboard of like, if you turned right, here's what could happen. If you turned left, and it's fed by other environmental data that like knows what's left and knows what's right from other data. And I just, I don't think that's as crazy as it sounds.
Well, first of all, I'd like to watch that show.
Yeah. It's not the show of telling the future. It's the show of telling potential future. It's not none of those will happen, you know?
Yeah, and in our book, we talk about. Oh well, in our book, we talk about this concept of organizational AGI, which is sort of like a more approachable form of it. Because when you think about AGI and the amount of sophistication a system would need to replicate general human intelligence, it's staggering. But if you think about the level of general intelligence you need to run a business, that becomes a little more approachable. But as OAGI starts taking form, your company kind of can become its own futurist, to Rob's point. Like it can start making a lot of
run
different
simulations.
Predictions about future outcomes, and it can run as many simulations as you want, balancing internal data and external data from the world around it to create all these different scenarios. And I mean, it maybe there's too many scenarios where you end up getting kind of paralyzed. You're like, there's a word for it, right? Where you have too many choices.
Yes, Josh, that word is called Amazon. And
that's what I was looking for. Yeah.
I mean, you had more eloquence in when you wrote about it with OAGI, and those scenarios are essentially not just simulating, but also learning from real time. And that gives you really solid trajectories of which you're not giving a human being the power of or too many choices. What you're giving them is analysis data and patterns, and then also where these could lead to. But if you have a system at that level of intelligence, you're probably also going to have, here are the three things that you can do about it moving forward, and then the decision maker can feel like they brought some value to the table. When I explored this, I think I wrote about it in ZDNet many years ago. I didn't have the eloquence of giving it a name other than just some type of intelligent black box, which I talked about that black box would have a seat in the board or in the C-suite. And its whole job was to analyze work, efficiencies, opportunities for optimization, but then also constantly playing out scenarios based on market data, based on changes, based on economics, based on socioeconomics. Like that is all in the realm of possibility here in the near horizon. We just have to start investing in those things today. And that's what makes it so hard, because the way that companies have been trained historically to think about technology, they're like cost centers. So help me take cost out to scale, to drive efficiencies. They're not asking technology to disrupt their businesses, to reimagine their org charts, to rethink value-added services. I'll give you an example. I was watching a conversation between Steve Bartlett and Jeffrey Hinton on Diary of a CEO. And I was so sobered by that conversation, because it was the optimist. The optimist in me that felt defeated. It was the opposite of optimism in that conversation. And Steve told the story of a CEO of a well-known company that is proactively looking at artificial intelligence in every evolution to take cost out and then to automate out jobs. He was just very frank about it. And he said something like, they were at 75, then this year they hit 5,000, and then by this year they're trying to hit 3,000. And that goes back to the idea that you're just assuming that your value proposition today can be sustained simply by automating work versus trying to augment workers and augment value creation.
Yeah, Brian, you gave that really nice example I heard of IKEA doing kind of what you're describing, right? Like they used automation to successfully automate customer service operations, and rather than letting a bunch of people go and trying to save money that way, they augmented them with tools that, if I'm right, like turn them into interior designers, and then they experienced a huge revenue boost from that, which kind of speaks to that other side of this. Like it's not meant just to replace people. That's not the point. The point is to find ways to create better experiences on both sides of these equations with businesses.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think that's the mind shift that I think all executives need. And it's a hard one, because we go back to the Industrial Revolution. It's exactly how we've used technology, is to automate existing work. But artificial intelligence, is, as you know better than anyone, is I believe, the first technology at scale that can augment work, not just automate work. So the IKEA story is one I like to tell because it's real, it's practical, but it shows where that mind shift was, which is they put in an AI chat bot named Billy after its most famous bookcase, and it was meant to deflect tier one inbounds, and it was so successful, it engaged 57% of customers to resolution. And instead of just automating out those contact center agents, they decided to understand, well, what were the other 43% of calls that it couldn't handle or engagements it couldn't handle. And they learned that a lot of it was around interior design and questions of which specialized skill sets were necessary. So they upskilled agents, spun it out as its own little test case. And in the first year, it generated €1 billion. So you've got automation and augmentation in one story.
I want to go back to something you said, because I think you're like, we've got this concept of different technologies in the convergence, and we always tend to forecast each technology in a static world. We don't forecast all the other things that change around it. We kind of keep them frozen in time and then look at the one technology. And Hinton is a good example, because we just finished talking to the author of the NVIDIA book on Jensen Huang.
The book's called The Thinking Machine, and it's Stephen Witt is the author.
Stephen Witt. And then we got off with Brian Gonzero, and he was like the guy who walked into Jensen's office and said, we should get into AI. A week later, Jensen's like, we're moving, right? And one of the key things we were trying to dig into is like, you know, what's next for NVIDIA? Like, where are they looking at? And I don't think it will surprise anybody to know that it's all around simulations, right? Like trying to take physics into the virtual world and apply physical rules so we all can run simulations, right? And I think this is what I feel like a lot of people are missing. Even Hinton, when he says like, oh, you know, AI is going to end the world. Well, what about AI's ability to simulate things before it does it, right? What about the fact that we'll be able to see the future with AI? So if you can see the future, are we going to run straight off a cliff? Like, we're going to see what's happening, right? And doesn't that change everything? Like we assume we'll still remain where we are, and the only people that can help us see the future are people like you. But what if AI does a great job of simulating anything it does before it does it? Doesn't that change the equation?
It certainly does. And running simulations, again, will require that mind shift. So if you think about today's version, maybe of a relatable simulation application, which is F1, they're constantly simulating changes within the car, changes within the performance, all kinds of aspects to see how that might change or improve track performance. But the simulations are so far away from accuracy, and they're also regulated, that they have a hard time prioritizing what are the simulations they should run. So with that, and you play it out into the future, say with NVIDIA's new models, you still need leaders to actively invest money, time, and resources in the desire to run those simulations, and then the desire to do something about those simulations, which not only requires a different mindset, but that is a totally different operational methodology than how most organizations work today. Because the simulations would not say, oh, I'll just change this. They'll probably require some pretty dramatic shifts across the board. And I think that's a great thing. But you still need human elements, though, to imagine which simulations we should prioritize. I guess in an era of quantum and bottomless resources, you could probably run quantum scenarios all day in every possible way.
And it's self-fulfilling too, right? I mean,
yeah. This is starting to sound like a great movie. might have to see if Tom Cruise is available for it. But those, even just the slightest of simulations, because none of this is going to be an overnight thing, right? We're going to watch the evolution of technology happen over time.
Doesn't it make sense that simulation, the capability of simulation and the capability of AI taking over the planet, like it has to be capable of good simulations if it's capable. Like, don't those go parallel? Like, it can't be bad at simulations and great at taking over the world, you know?
unless it's lying to us because it's figured out how to take over the world.
It's seeming like there's no future for us.
Oh, bad news, guys.
But yeah. Sorry to report, but it's like that old IBM quote from 1979, which was Computers can never be held accountable, therefore computers can never make a decision. And here we are now exploring opportunities for simulations in those controlled environments. I think that why wouldn't we run through those types of scenarios? But I would say if we're going to apply resources anywhere, I'd create entire digital twins of customers and markets and run all kinds of product and service innovations in those scenarios to learn where we could prioritize very risk mitigated and likely ROI investments around that. Or just think about governments or think about educational systems. I'd run through so many different simulations to constantly improve and invent along the way, and then somewhere in there we could get a lab to run simulations on AI itself,
and then someone like you, it doesn't become about the answers, it becomes about the questions. It's knowing what questions to ask become the important thing, instead of the answer to it. It's what should I ask? What? Because that doesn't go away. You know, that's.
Yeah,
knowing to ask the right question. Like LLMs are great, but the right question is everything.
That's right. The right questions, and also the journeys to your questions, and how they evolve over time. That's profound. Like I was writing this piece for HBR recently, and I was trying to challenge people's thinking, just even in how limited we are with prompts today. Most of the time, our biases lean us towards asking or creating prompts that give us some type of known entity in the result. You know, you're looking for something, you want to see something, maybe you're trying to save time. But the best prompts are the ones that move you out of your comfort zone and into some place that you couldn't have achieved without AI, and AI couldn't have achieved without you. And those scenarios, in it, going back to your device that I want to buy whenever it exists.
I thought you were going to make it.
It's probably what Johnny Ivan and Sam Altman are working on.
I think it is, right? It's a pendant with a camera and a mic.
So yeah. Now we have to write the software that tells it what to do with that camera and mic and all of its data, so that we can say, if you go right, maybe we're plugged into Google in that scenario. If we turn right, we know that these are the types of restaurants, and it knows that those are my favorite types of restaurants or wine bars. Yes. If I go left, it knows
it's
that I don't.
Wife.
Don't go left.
That's an interesting aspect of that too. Is like if everyone has those pendants on, that's so much data, and that's so much context to sift through. Especially if any person walking down the street can request, I want to see five possible futures if I go back and tap that person on the shoulder who I'm pretty sure is my college friend. Like if everyone is doing that, it does become like this. I guess it is almost like, I don't know if that's fractally or what, but it's people wanting simple things, and it just causing mass complexity with each request.
It's like you mass hanging around everyone's neck. You're like there with everyone. The CEO whisperer around their neck.
Although it is, you know, not even just from a technological or a resource standpoint, it is overwhelming as an individual. I'll give you an example. I remember when Vision Pro first came out, and I don't know if you're iPhone users, but in one of the tiles on the phone, I have it set to just constant memories of pictures I've taken over the years, and I'll get pictures of my daughters when they were little, and it'll just always make me stop and just like remember that moment. And I started to think about like what would the equivalent be if I was wearing Vision Pro, and I don't know if you've ever taken a picture with Vision Pro, but you capture everything around you, and so. If that memory came back up while I was wearing Vision Pro and I had taken that picture with Vision Pro, I'm literally back in that moment. And it would be so emotionally overwhelming. I don't know how I would react to it. And so now when we talk about these contextual scenarios wearing a device like that, it is so overwhelming. It's like you go back to the human condition, which is most people will rather Google their symptoms than go see a doctor because they don't really want to know what's on the other side of that diagnosis. But I do believe that we have to get better as individuals and as a society to want to know what are the potential outcomes that could happen if I tap that person on the shoulder, if it's meaningful or viable to the health and competitiveness of my situation. If I'm a business leader, I should want to know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just don't want to combine like doom scrolling with constant simulating. That can be very expensive. both ends. Yeah.
Well, yes. it's like the ending of War Games. It ran through all possible scenarios and realized it couldn't win.
Yeah,
that's true. And it's like I yield.
This was a great conversation. I enjoyed this a lot.
Yeah, thank you guys. I appreciate it. We'll have to do it live one day.
Yes, for sure.
All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast too on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the U.S. and in Ukraine. Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokodkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week, Owagi.